Protests have taken place in dozens of US cities after a grand jury in Louisville in Kentucky ruled that three police officers would not stand trial for their involvement in the death of Breonna Taylor. A former member of Ronald Reagan's administration tells us why the Republican Party's current stance on immigration needs to be overhauled. And as the Zurich International Film Festival gets underway, we'll assess how film festival season has adapted amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Monocle's editors and correspondents tackle those subjects today here on the late edition on Monocle 24. Hello there and a very warm welcome to you to the late edition here on Monocle 24. It is Thursday, the 24th of September, and I'm Thomas Lewis here in Toronto. And joining us today to cast their expert eyes across some of the day's main news stories from around the world are Monocle 24's Carlotta Ribello and Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak. Carlotta, Chris, great to have you with us on the show today. How is the week treating you both there in London?
Well, it's been quite a busy week so far, Tom. It doesn't help as well that the sun has decided to disappear and temperature dropped around like 10 degrees overnight. So we're bracing for winter already. But here at Midori House, it's been quite busy. People have just returned from the Chiefs Conference that happened last weekend. So a lot of inspiring ideas and stories for the weeks to come that we picked up over there.
And Chris, how about you? Feeling similarly inspired, as Carlotta mentioned there this week?
Similarly downcast about the change in weather after holding like what felt like would probably be a final barbecue over the weekend. It has now turned. And in terms of busyness, yes, similar. Also, as you know, inspired by trying to organize a series of interviews with interesting people ahead of the U.S. elections. So we're working on a series of interviews to run across M24 and our magazines. People like Charlie Sykes, Chris Wallace, Jane Fonda. We have a whole bunch of people coming up in our next issues and on the radio. So it's been exciting to work on that.
Well, Chris Chermak and Carlotta Ribello, it's great to have you with us on the programme today. Well, let's begin in the United States, where protests have taken place in dozens of US cities following the announcement from Louisville, Kentucky yesterday that charges won't be brought against the three police officers for their involvement in the death of Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old woman who was shot dead in her home during a police raid on the 13th of March this year. One of the officers at the scene that night has been indicted on three counts of wanton endangerment for firing multiple rounds into the apartment complex where Breonna Taylor lived from a parking lot outside. Breonna Taylor's death has become a focal point for the Black Lives Matter demonstrations. And here now is some sound from one of last night's protests outside the Barclays Center in Brooklyn in New York City. Well, during last night's demonstrations in Louisville itself, where Breonna Taylor was killed, two police officers were shot and injured. The demonstrations against systemic racism in the US over the past few months and the pockets of violence that have marked some of them have become a central campaign theme for Donald Trump, who sought to use them as proof of the Democratic Party's failings on law and order. Well, with more on this, we spoke a little earlier today to Amy Pope of the Chatham House think tank in London on today's edition of The Briefing.
I think the president revels in the theater of it. You know, he's not looking at what lives are being lost in the protests or how people are feeling or reacting to the rule of law. He loves the fact that there are protests. He loves to point his finger to it and make the case that that's why he should be the president. He sees no inconsistency with that behavior and his own law-defying behavior because he just doesn't operate in the same rule of law that past presidents have operated within. I mean, I'm not sure he even completely understands it. What he understands is the theater of the moment and the way to exploit that.
Amy Pope, a former senior member of the Obama White House there, speaking to us a little earlier today. Carlotta, when you heard the ruling from Louisville, Kentucky yesterday, what was your reaction to it?
I think the best way to describe it is outrage. I just, you know, as we've been following this story for a while and, you know, the movement that it has been at the center of it all and the demands for justice, the fact that not one of the officers involved in her death were charged with murder it just shows what needs to change in the system. You know, two of the officers that were there that night are still employed. They didn't have any form of punishment altogether. the one that got, you know, as we just heard, that got charged by wanton endangerment is not even about endangering Breonna Taylor herself, but actually because he shot a patio door and windows, so he endangered the neighborhood. I just don't understand what other message you need to send that says clearly that things need to change, that this is not okay, that something is fundamentally broken. And we can't forget that just earlier this month, officials in the state have agreed to pay her family around $12 million in a settlement. So that recognizes some sort of guilt, some sort of behavior that was not appropriate, some sort of... It just doesn't add up how you can, on one hand, have officials saying, yes, we need to pay the settlement because we were in the wrong. And then when a verdict comes out, the most dangerous thing that was done is that a patio door got damaged.
And Chris, the narrative that Amy Pope, who we heard from a few moments ago, that Donald Trump's re-election campaign is forging here on law and order, is that an effective one, do you think, so far, particularly as new moments, as we're seeing right now in Louisville and other cities across the US, as those moments keep emerging, that then bring protesters once again out onto the streets?
You know, Thomas, unfortunately, I think it could be. There's a difference between what is morally appropriate and what you should be saying as a president to unify a country and the politics that we so often focus on when it comes to an election race. And sadly, I think when it comes to the politics, it is possible that Trump will have an effect, you know, for those of us who, and I would count myself in a way in this, for those of us who, if you want, feel safe, who do not have to go through what African Americans go through every day in terms of the impact that police brutality and other aspects of this systemic bias have on their everyday life. For those of us who don't have to go through that, an appeal to safety and an appeal that safety, our safety, is under threat can be a very powerful thing. It can be something that convinces people. And unfortunately, I do think in the case of Breonna Taylor in particular, there's a lot of nuance that makes it very easy for people to pick what they want to pick, if you will, because this was a little bit different than a case of, say, George Floyd or others in the past, because there was a shooting that was involved. There's so many complications, if you will, that are very hard to go into in a brief sort of spot. But, you know, there were all these details about that you can pick and choose whichever way you want to go. The fact that Breonna Taylor was not alone, her boyfriend had a gun, which he had a right to own. Whether the search warrant that the police had was good, was right to be carried out. Did they knock on the door before entering? Should they have entered after midnight? And everyone, I think, and conservatives will focus on this, and they will focus more on the simple aspect that there was a shootout. The police had a right to respond when they were fired upon by this boyfriend. Others will, of course, focus on the fact that the police shouldn't have been there in the first place and that they responded disproportionately to what was happening. And so there are so many complications in this. And as Carlotta said there, I think the focus in a way for me in this case, arguably, is just on how broken the system is and how to what extent the rules on the appropriate use of force for police remain so inconclusive in many states around the country that it is very hard to take action in these kinds of cases against police. And so real change will only come about through broader reforms that can better hold police accountable, and that's the kind of thing that people in the streets are demanding as well.
Well, let's stay in the United States next here on The Late Edition, where it's time to bring you a glimpse of Monocle's October issue. In the issue, in the affairs pages, we asked 46 figures in the United States and around the world who represent all parts of the political spectrum on how the winner of this November's presidential election should go about designing a better America. We've spoken to mayors, diplomats, activists, news anchors, architects, and figures from the business and the cultural sectors, and you'll be hearing some of those voices cases here on the Late Edition in the weeks to come. Today, we hear from Linda Chavez. She is a Republican, and she was the most senior woman to work in the White House of Ronald Reagan during his administrations in the 1980s. She's a self-described never Trump voter, and here she is now, speaking to me on the telephone from Colorado a few weeks ago on what, in her view, should be the priority for the next occupant of the building in which she used to work.
I think one of the great things about the United States is that we are a nation that's built on an idea. It's built on the principle of equal rights under the law, that all men are created equal. And I think that the way in which to try to build a better America is to recognize that we are one nation and one people, and that we have to work together, even when we have differences, to overcome those differences and to realize that we are part of a greater whole. And so that would be my emphasis. I think the Republican Party under Donald Trump has strayed very far from its ideals and its roots as the party of Abraham Lincoln. I think that, unfortunately, the Trump Republican Party has sought to sow division and to emphasize identity politics. And it's ironic because in the past, it's been the Democratic Party that has emphasized those kinds of racial and ethnic identity politics. And the Republican Party had in the past really rejected that notion. But now there has been a whole kind of grievance movement that has built up around Donald Trump and his Republican Party, in which whites are led to believe that they are the victims of enormous discrimination and that they are fighting for their identity, fighting for their heritage, fighting for their history. And I just reject that.
Linda Chavez, a former White House official during the Ronald Reagan administration, speaking to us for the October issue of Monocle magazine. Carlotta, to begin with you, the characterization of what the Republican Party has become under President Trump, as Linda outlined there, is bearing out in a pretty keen way at the moment, isn't it? Particularly with the push to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the US Supreme Court.
Yes, and I think what's becoming more evident than ever is how the Republican Party and Donald Trump no longer are the same. That's why you have so many Republican supporters that do not support the current iteration of the Republican Party. It has become almost, I dare to say, a cult of personality than anything else. And obviously we know the dangers that that poses, but that's why you then have movements like Republican Voters Against Trump emerging, because it is not representing the core values of the party. And yes, now, you know, the move to fill this vacancy on the Supreme Court, you know, just a few days away from the election, when it was back during Barack Obama's last year in office, 7 months before the election, you had all these Republican senators trying to justify why that was too soon. And now I think it was 39 days before that we still have to go for the vote. And now it's simply, that's fine. Whereas we know that confirmation processes take on average 70 days. So trying to rush through that. But I also kind of wanted to talk about, you know, the comments we heard from Trump late last night and today about how he has basically refused to commit to this peaceful transfer of power if he loses the election on November 3rd. And it is something, you know, that is quite scary to hear a president saying that. But back to the point of, you know, the Republican Party of now, the fact that you've had, you know, people like Mitch McConnell to come out and say, regardless of what happens, regardless of who wins, we Republicans are committed to a peaceful transfer of power. If you had seen this playing out in any other country in the world, the United States would be the first one to point a finger at them and to say, we need to be careful, we need to, you know, maybe send observers to their election to take care and make sure this is a smooth process, not only the vote itself, but then the transition. And you have a president that's giving all indications, you know, from the way he's been dealing with the mail-in ballots, everything else, and the postal service, giving every indication that if there's a hurdle he can put on the way of voters, he will do that. If that guarantees him and second term, and forcing people of your own party to kind of say what's been happening since this country was founded will keep on happening. It's quite insane. I never thought we would be here, particularly with the United States, a country that loves going to other countries when they do exactly this.
And Chris, to turn our attention to the October issue for a moment, you and I worked pretty closely together on this feature for which Linda Chavez and many others spoke to us. The goal, I think it's fair to say, was to bring together a collection of voices that didn't amount to an echo chamber of sorts of views and of political motivations. Was there one voice among them that struck you most particularly during the process of pulling all these voices together?
Well, there were a number of voices, of course, that I could pick. I think to your point, Thomas, it was interesting to do this in part because, as you know, we specifically phrased the question about what would you do to design a better America if you were in the Oval Office to actually try and almost take a bit of the politics out of it. We sort of intentionally asked people for issues, for things that they would like to do, rather than focusing on either of the candidates specifically and what they expect them to do. And so I think out of that came a lot of interesting remarks. For me, the two elements that were most interesting perhaps was, you know, this idea of trying to reduce the polarization of the United States in different ways came out quite regularly. You know, we spoke to, for example, Anthony Kennedy, who was an alderman of the 10th District in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which goes back to what we were talking about in the first example today. And he just told me that his quote was, "We have lost the ability to be empathetic. Empathy is one of the things I would ask for in the next president. We have to understand how people are living and experiencing things in our community. It might be fine on one side of the street. It might not be fine on the other side. Empathy will make you a better lawmaker." And I think those kinds of comments came through quite a bit in many of these, the effort to combat polarization, and on the international front, to Carlotta's point as well, in a similar way, an effort also there to be more unified on the international stage, to appeal again to allies, to work with allies together to present a united front to threats that the U.S. and Europe, for example, are facing. Even, you know, we had a few comments throughout this about, for example, also how to face up to China, and that in terms of China emerging as a new power, the U.S. and Europe could be much more united in their approach to that. And that was something you heard through a lot of the former ambassadors and others that we spoke to in this.
Well, you can read more of those perspectives on the upcoming election in the United States in the October issue of Monocle magazine, which is out now. Well, finally here on the late edition, you'd be forgiven for missing that it's film festival season, given everything else that's going on right now. The Toronto International Film Festival, held in a much more streamlined way this year, concluded earlier this week, and today marks the opening of the Zurich International Film Festival. Christian Jungen is the festival's new artistic director, and he told The Globalist here on Monocle 24 a little earlier today about the challenges of staging an in-person festival this year.
I've always said we're either going to do the physical event or we're going to cancel. Because I'm an advocate of the theatrical experience, I want to bring people together to enjoy a film together. I'm fed up with Zoom meetings and Teams meetings. I think after all these months, people are eager to come together and enjoy a movie as a collective audience. So this was our mission and we stick to it. And now we realize that people are hungry to go back. The movies are under pressure, the theaters are in danger, and we're going to celebrate the comeback of cinema.
Christian Jungen, Artistic Director of the Zurich International Film Festival, there speaking to us a little earlier today, and the festival gets underway in Switzerland today too. Carlotta, it would have been easy, as Christian Jungen suggested there, just to cancel, I suppose, a lot of these marquee film events this year. But those that have gone ahead have done so in quite an interesting way, haven't they?
Yes, and they found this quite interesting balance between what can be done in this digital format and what can be done in a physical format. And I think that hybrid between the two worlds is what allowed for a lot of these film festivals to go ahead. I mean, looking ahead here in London to the BFI Sci-Fi Film Festival, which is due to start on the 7th of October, you know, they're doing 50 of the premieres virtually, but then 12 new films will actually be on screen in theatres here across the UK. And I think that is very important for film festivals. It's interesting how, you know, one of the events that is made for a screen actually does not work in your small screen at home. It has to have the experience with it. But it's nice to see how many of these events have been able to go ahead, even if part of it has to be digital, even if there's not as much networking as usual. But it is important for everyone and, of course, for the industry as well. As we all know, the arts are in need of some help now.
And Chris, a film that gained a lot of attention at TIFF here in Toronto this year was The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. It looks absolutely terrific. Can't wait to go and see it if I can. Are there any films currently on the film festival circuit this year that have caught your eye?
Well, another one actually that also made some waves in Toronto, I believe, which is Nomadland. I find an interesting one, also potentially up for Oscars. It stars Frances McDormand, who I've always been a fan of, including in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which is one of her last films. And similarly, this looks really at life in the U.S. of sort of modern day nomads in the U.S., the story about a woman in her 60s who loses her job after in rural Nevada and sort of goes on the road and sort of experiences this life of a modern day nomad, finding different jobs in different places, living out of her van. It's meant to be quite an evocative look at this difficult life that people have in parts of the American West. And that's definitely one I'd like to see.
Well, so many interesting films doing the rounds during this year's film festival circuit, and hopefully we'll be able to cross the threshold of an actual cinema to go and see it one day. Chris Chermak and Carlotta Ribello, that's all we have time for today's edition of the programme. Thank you to the two of you for being with us on the show today. Our studio manager today in London was David Stevens. A big thanks to him, as always, too. The late edition returns at the same time tomorrow, but do stay with us here at Monocle 24 for more news, more discussion, and much more. I'm Thomas Lewis here in Toronto. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.